We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome on in. This is the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast. We're talking winners and losers from last weekend's NFL Combine. A lot of movement. A certain record was broken by one Xavier Worthy. You may have heard about that pretty fast. We'll talk about him and his new value. And we're also going to get into some of the losers from the Combine, some guys that did not particularly perform well, and then some early best ball reactions from the Combine. Let's start the show. Welcome on in. This is the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast for the post-combine. I'm your host, John McKechnie. That is Mario Puig. So, Mario, as I've said, I'm going to probably set the record for saying the word combine over this next hour or so, but the combine was last weekend, and you know, we had some of the headliners not participate, and yet We still had some pretty unbelievable stuff happen on the field there. So, I mean, it was really entertaining. I was really dialed in pretty much all afternoon on Saturday, watching all the running backs and receivers go through their drills. So I want to get things rolling, starting with some of the receivers in particular that you thought came away well, guys who kind of elevated their stocks last weekend. And I want to start with kind of the man of the hour. And that is Xavier Worthy, because we talked about him a lot. We both kind of expected him to be the fastest receiver at the combine. I don't think either of us expected him to break John Ross's record necessarily. But, you know, your thoughts on him now. And you know, I think it's interesting when you look at the comparable, you know, players in the past that have run the low 4.2s. It doesn't always portend a ton of NFL success, but Worthy's interesting because he was actually productive over the course of three seasons at Texas. So your thoughts there.
Right. So the 4.21 broke Ross's 4.22. I think there was an unofficial time a couple of years ago where Tyquan Thornton was briefly quoted at 4.21. So this is the first official time that combine has given the 4.21, though, and I don't know how much it means specifically. It obviously confirms that Worthy is extremely fast. Maybe we can just assume, you know, the fastest or second fastest player in the league. I guess, you know, Tyreek Hill eventually is going to have to lose a half of a step, and a 4.21 40 seems like it might, you know, catch him basically. So that kind of speed, it is interesting to know it's the fastest or whatever degree to which Worthy is faster than most receivers. But he already was in that category to begin with. And even if he had run a 4.29, it's like he would more or less be the same player. So it's interesting, and it's a big accomplishment for him. It's sort of clarifies the picture with him a little bit. You know, it would have been quite damaging for his draft stock if he had gone into the combine branded as, you know, the fast guy, the guy who's super fast and no one's faster than him. And if he got there and ran like an, you know, 4.37 or something, that would have been actually a disastrous thing. But the 4.21 great as an accomplishment as it is, I think it mostly just reinforces the narrative we had about Worthy going in, which to me was like always a top 40 kind of player.
So, you know, but again, we had established that he was fast. Now we know that he's game breaking fast, and that's great and all. But I think it's important to look at that within the greater athletic profile of him. You know, he's someone who's what, 5'11", 165.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not huge. But you know, we've seen light receivers do extremely well in the NFL. You know, Tank Dell, smaller guy. But around that same weight, did you know, obviously had the good rookie season. Hollywood Brown, another good example. It's weight Worthy kind of reminds me a little bit of Hollywood Brown. I don't know. I saw the eyebrow raise there. So,
I had some autoplay. I was trying to load a combine results page, and it started doing like a Home Depot ad or something. So, if you didn't hear that, that's good. I wasn't reacting to you though.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Sorry. But you know, again, point being that you know we know that he's fast and all, but you know how applicable can that speed be if the frame is problematic? So, do we think that the general athleticism on Worthy is good enough to kind of like supersede just the kind of obvious limitations he has with the frame?
Yeah, the 165 is very light, of course, but one thing you can keep in mind too is that's like a negotiable frame, right? He had 4.21 at 165 means if he wanted to, he could push more like 175 a year from now and still be, you know, the second fastest receiver in the league, something like that. So when you're talking 4.21, you're talking such an extreme level of speed that it starts to offset other parts of his profile that might otherwise be deficient. And his weight, it grades as deficient, clearly. So if you have a deficiency in one category, you might be able to offset it a little with a surplus in another. And yeah, the 4.21 speed, it's like, you know, as far as the weight concern goes in practice, it's the concern of like boxing out and going over the middle, right? And boxing out is something you need to do if you can't create separation on a play. And you're going to have the means to create separation with a 4.21 40, even at 165, because you're not going to get approached the same way by all the corners you play as the corners going against like Gabe Davis or something. You know, it's like you're not going to put a corner right up in Worthy's face with no help over the top unless you want trouble as a defense.
Yeah.
You know, so if the catch scenario were just you're right next to this corner and you got to catch it, yeah, Worthy's not that great. But when you're talking about a 2.5 seconds, 3 seconds to get open, he can create the space necessary for his size deficiency to not matter for the play, or you know, frequently enough he can do that, that in the end it turns out being like a you know, wide receiver two type who offsets volume limitations with big plays and decoy utility. Like even when Worthy's not catching, if Worthy finishes a game with 3 catches, it's not just those 3 catches that he's giving you. It's that he's probably occupying safeties at depths, or you can at least dictate that the safety stay back at certain parts of the field where you want to create cover for your wide receiver one or just whatever other parts of your offense. So Worthy's a guy who, you know, if you needed him for some reason to be a 150 target player in the NFL, he'll probably disappoint you. He'll probably have drops. He'll probably have little miscues that sort of add up over time and irritate people over time. That happened at Texas, but rather than a 30% target share like he had at Texas, it's probably going to be more like, I don't know, 19 to 21 in the NFL. And that will limit his catch upside. Yes. But if he can give you high yards per target, if he can score, you know, DeSean Jackson was kind of a player like that, you know, he'd offset, you know, modest frame, modest target upside with, you know, 16 yards a catch, a touchdown every 4.5 catches, stuff like that. And Worthy can be that kind of player, which can be good in both real life purposes and fantasy purposes, depending on, you know, the price that he goes for.
So in real life, do we think that he's now firmly in the first round conversation, or do we think that, you know, this class being as deep as it is at receiver, that maybe he's still like a high round two?
I think he's higher in real life rankings, probably. I think he was already, even before the combine, in that first round conversation, because he always had unique decoy, big playability upside. And a guy like that, you know, he's again, as long as you just don't put the pressure on him to catch 90 passes, he can catch 55 or 60 for you and be still pushing 1,000 yards and still be pushing double digit touchdowns. And that kind of player is really valuable, especially if they also give you decoy utility to keep the rest of the offense covered from the safeties up top. So he was always a top 32 consideration. I think for the Chiefs, he always made sense because even if he's not Tyreek Hill, he can, you know, create more room for the whole offense. And that's just one of those categorical things, you know, that degree of speed working with Mahomes is always something worth looking into, I think. So, you know, if the Chiefs take him 30 seconds or something like that, that wouldn't be shocking. I don't think it would have been shocking before the combine either. The one thing, I don't know where people are putting him in like their dynasty rankings overall right now, but I do think you need to prepare for the possibility that Worthy's a little bit better in real life than in fantasy, especially in this PPR era. He might finish some seasons with like 45, 55 catches, and he still might be pushing for 1,000 yards or something. But even if he's doing like 16 yards a catch, 18 yards a catch, something like that, he will never be a guy who goes over 5 catches a game regularly. It's just the hands will become a problem at that point.
Right. He's not going to be a PPR merchant. That's for sure. Just as a stray comment, I grabbed him at the end of the 10th round on Monday in an underdog draft, and I was okay with that. I believe I took him over fellow rookie, incoming rookie, Keon Coleman. So I don't know.
I think he'll go ahead of Coleman. Yeah,
I do too. I think in real life, and I think the fantasy market will ultimately correct that way. As well. And then as far as the team fit, yeah, if Worthy can latch on with a kind of established team or get linked to a great quarterback such as Patrick Mahomes or a Josh Allen late in the first round, then, you know, as a Ravens fan, I would hate it. But as a general fan of watching a long bomb touchdown, I'm into that. So I'll make that concession. I'll fall on that sword. Let's get on to his teammate, A.D. Mitchell. You know, he was someone that we discussed last week as a player with a lot to gain or a lot to lose going into last weekend with the combine, because we had basically 1 year of real production to point to, obviously that being his junior year at Texas. Still didn't have the same amount of targets as Worthy, but he's big guy, and he proved to be an athlete. On top of it, really impressive stuff from Mitchell as far as, let's see, he ran the low 4.3s in the 40, which is great. I mean, just behind Brian Thomas to be the number three guy as far as the 40 times were concerned among receivers. And he also had the biggest broad jump, 136 inches. That's pretty far to be jumping from a stationary position. Also has almost a 40-inch vert. So a lot of catch radius to go with him, even though he did check in a bit shorter than was listed in Austin. He's 6'2", not 6'4".
Yeah, so a little shorter, like you said. It still projects for the same tasks, though. So he still primarily, I think, projects on the boundary, ideally toward the sideline, ideally far downfield. He could definitely do stuff after the catch underneath. I just think he's more the type that capitalizes on that when he has a cushion, and the cushion might kind of sometimes more so show up when he already demonstrates a threat earlier in the game. So I don't, in other words, I think if he's operating on the sideline and operating primarily downfield on the sideline, it's not going to be easy for Mitchell to draw the target volumes that people might be hoping he will in the NFL. I'm not saying he can't do better than he did at Texas, but the fact is at Texas, even with all the concerns about Worthy dropping passes and being too small or whatever, Worthy was drawing 30% of those targets at Texas, and Mitchell was kind of struggling to get over 20%. So he was super effective with those targets, and there's a really good case to make that Texas basically should have found and would have found a way to get him more targets if they were running this whole scenario again in 2024, but it didn't at Texas. And sometimes guys don't do more than they did in college because they have real limitations to their games, things that are, you know, subtle and aren't super obvious or even, you know, basically cannot be proven, you know, that they can still be in there. So with him, I think there's a certain amount of projection necessary. And since he has good age adjusted production, since he is, you know, blue chip athletic metrics, it is fair to project growth in Mitchell's game. And I guess the question of like how high he might go in the draft comes down to the question of like how much improvement in his game are NFL teams able to convince themselves of, like how much can he draw more like 27% of a team's targets than the 20% he was doing at Texas. If a team convinces themselves that he can and remain an above baseline, you know, above average efficiency receiver with that volume, then it makes sense to take him as high as like the top 20 picks or something like that. Whereas if he's more of a boundary type, a wide receiver two target volume, then I think he's still mostly, even with that, you know, really good 40 time. The 40 time was better than expected, by the way. I think the jumps were almost exactly what was expected of him. But I assumed he was more like 4.45 than 4.34. So there's no concern about where he can access the field. He can access all depths. He can be in any role, really, in terms of what the task is. It's just the question, I think, is like how many times can he do it and still beat the defense? You know, how much can the defense be keying on him and still lose to him? And because of Worthy, if only because of Worthy being in that offense at the same time as him, it's kind of difficult to tell, in my opinion. And it's kind of fair to assume either direction, project either direction, because I don't know how to call it more specifically.
Okay, so if we had to make a sort of role decision on A.D. Mitchell and what he can become at the next level, do you think the tools and the efficiency in the statistical profile and the tools that he showed at the combine, does that say more on the side of like a wide receiver one type in the future in the NFL?
In traits, traits for sure. It's just the question is like sometimes there's a skill element that I feel, at least, you can't really prove it's there. We can't really name it, describe it definitively in every case, but it's like it usually bears out in the numbers, right? And if there's something, if there's some kind of hitch in Mitchell's route running tendencies, if there's like some little hiccup at some point in the route running process where his spatial processing like slows down a second or gets tangled with, you know, his hand eye coordination or something like that, that might show up in the form of drawing 10 fewer target share points than a guy like Worthy, you know, that might just sort of be the closest we can get to proving it's there. But sometimes, especially when, you know, the younger a player is and the better the tools they have to work with, sometimes they overcome, you know, whatever they are at one point in time. Sometimes even if the problem's holding them down that 1 year, sometimes they need precisely 1 year to figure it out. And that's why if people get really optimistic about Mitchell, I don't have anything to push back against it. So if someone were seeing sort of, you know, rose colored glasses or not, if they were seeing like wide receiver one upside, I don't know how you would prove to them that it's not there.
Right. It's hard to say what one way or the other, but at this stage, I'm willing to take the optimistic view that he can develop into a wide receiver one type. And, you know, hopefully he winds up somewhere that they can, you know, really tap in and ultimately like unlock that potential that clearly seems to be there. I want to talk to you a little bit about Brian Thomas, because he's someone that we haven't discussed a ton on this podcast. I think for me, you know, just the one amazing year of production that, you know, obviously what was alongside Malik Nabers and playing alongside a Heisman Trophy winning quarterback. Interesting frame, and I certainly didn't expect Brian Thomas to run as fast as he did, especially for as tall as he is. I mean, for him to be 6'3" and run the 4.33 is pretty insane, right? He's the only receiver in our combine database at RotoWire, so going back to 2005, that's 6'3" and ran a 40 that fast. Just again, just the 1 year
in the 40 that fast. That was the fastest of 6'3".
Yes. Ran that little sort on there earlier. Again, everyone check out the our NFL Combine and Pro Day stats. We got filters on there. You can check out anything. You know, you can see which receiver has the best vertical jump that also weighs at least 215 pounds. You know, like you can do anything. You can go absolutely nuts with it. And I helped oversee the data entry. So I think it's up to snuff. But basically, like, I don't know, the only recent example that I found of a guy with a similar frame and athletic profile, this might not sound overly great to the listeners, Denzel Mims. What makes him different than Denzel Mims, Brian Thomas?
Well, Thomas's production at LSU, I would say, was better than Mims's was at Baylor. The deal with Mims at Baylor was he was actually below baseline in the Baylor offense until he was, I want to say, 21 and a half, which is to say the fourth year age generally. And up until that point, you know, he was kind of struggling to produce. And then when he reached the age of like a fourth year player, he kind of went nuts and dominated that last year at Baylor, then had the really good athletic testing, like you said. Mims must have been like a 4.38 though, right? Not that it all comes down to this question, but difference
I'll goes. Hunt that down.
I think he must have been like a 4.38, because the 4.33 would have kind of surprised me, but also 6.3, 208 or 209, whatever Thomas is, I'm assuming was a better build. But for me, it's not so much the trait similarity, the physical trait similarity between those two that would give me any concern. It's more, it would lie more in the production, and specifically, this is a lot like Aiden I. Mitchell. How many targets, what target share can Brian Thomas draw and still remain an above average, you know, efficiency receiver? And like Mitchell, I think it's fair to view it quite optimistically. I think it requires a little or a lot of projection, but it's hard to pin down Thomas's profile in the meantime, and you know, not being able to demonstrate a negative, you know, necessarily concedes that the upside is also the upside scenario, the optimistic scenario is possible. And in the case of Thomas, the concern is, like Mitchell relative to Xavier Worthy, Thomas drew not just fewer targets than Malik Nabers. He drew like a lot less. Nabers was, I think it was about 10 points ahead of Thomas in the target share counts. However, you know, two things you got to note there. One, Nabers might be a uniquely good player. So if you're not as good as a guy who might end up being a top five receiver in the NFL, it's fine. And it might not be meaningful in the end. The other thing is Thomas was so outrageously explosive with his usage that even though Nabers was awesome with his 30% or so target share, there's still a pretty compelling case to make that LSU should have prioritized getting more targets for Thomas. And if the sample had increased another 12 games, maybe that's exactly what would have happened. Maybe LSU would have gone to Thomas a little bit more until his, you know, yard per target dropped below 13 yards or whatever it was. And until his catch rate dropped below 75 or whatever, you know, it was like 78 catch percentage and like 12 yards a target and a touchdown every 3.5 catches. Like, yep. that's yes, you're not going to him regularly. You're basically making him a 3-point specialist in that role, but he's making so many of the shots, you're kind of like compelled to make him shoot more, see what happens at the very least, because we don't know in the meantime what target rate Brian Thomas could have incurred at LSU and still return numbers like that. He would have probably started seeing struggles at some point that he didn't last year if he had been exposed more, but we don't know. It's not like they gave him the exposure and he failed. It just never happened.
Yeah. So that is an interesting point, because the per catch per target numbers this year were unbelievable. Didn't really have a ton of production to point to in his previous two seasons.
It was a bit of a struggle. I will say that. And that's why I'm kind of, more than in Mitchell's case, I'm leaning in Thomas's case that I'm a little concerned he'll never be a full route tree guy. He might be one of those sideline. He could run from the slot, I'm sure, but I think it's still going to be like vertically oriented. Like, you're going to make him run high depth of target from the slot when he's there. And when you're always high average depth of target, when you're always furthest away from the quarterback, it's hard to draw a target every 6 snaps. You know, you might end up drawing one more like every 10 snaps. And so then at that point, the yards per target and the touchdown percentage become important again. But I think at worst, he projects well in that respect. Like, if Thomas does not get, you know, wide receiver one level target volume in the NFL, he'll still give you high efficiency, high explosiveness on that volume. So it, you know, not a dud like some other players could be.
Okay. And then lastly, one other potential comparison to throw at you. I don't know if there's a better person to be asking about this one than yourself. Do you see any DJ Chark similarities?
Well, there are a few. DJ Chark ran the 4.34, I think it was, at his combine. And
you were right about Mims, by the way, right on the dot, 4.38.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so Thomas has to be, you know, a step or close to a step faster than Mims, in addition to having the better numbers. So hopefully that comp, you know, hopefully that is a miss for that reason. But as far as Chark goes, that's a complicated answer for me because I still think Chark is good. I think he's got limitations in so far as he's slight and not built to take hits, basically. So in other words, you wouldn't want Chark running a slant from the slot. But that one year he mostly stayed healthy, Gardner Minshew's rookie year, the Jags used him all over the place, including from the slot, but mostly vertically, you know, and then on the sideline he was working a lot. Did great with it, and then he got hurt a bunch. And even this year, working as a sideline vertical specialist for the Panthers, you'll notice he was much more efficient than their baseline. So I think Chark is good. I think his downfall has been that he's gotten hurt so much that it's developed, it's drawn alienation from the NFL, basically, and now he's just regarded as soft or somebody who can't take coaching, which is the other thing they hate. They hate players who kind of like grumble or anything like that. And that, I don't know, Chark, you know, he keeps getting these lowly mercenary jobs and always plays pretty well and never gets any kind of acknowledgement anyway. So in the sense that, like, I think Chark is good and has still had a kind of disappointing career. It's possible. Like, if I just think it's mostly bad luck rather than similarities in their traits that had much to do with it. And, If Thomas fails in the NFL for the same reason as Chark, it's just to pretty much say bad luck, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, because Chark obviously talented and does have, you know, a couple good seasons like on his resume. It's just the health stuff. I mean, was it early on in the Urban Meyer Jag season where he hurt his leg in that Thursday night game, and it's just like, yeah, you know, he could have had a good season that year even with all the dysfunction that was going on in Jacksonville. But
apparently, you know, Trent Baalke got really pissed off at him for being hurt too much or something. And I wouldn't be surprised if that idiot kind of told anybody who had listened, like, you know, Chark's too soft. You can't get anything out of him. I don't know why anybody would listen to Trent Baalke, but maybe they listen to his negative pitches. Maybe they trust him for the low, you know, dirt on others, even if he doesn't know how to, you know, do basic addition and subtraction.
No, he does not, as far as we know. So we've dug in on three guys in pretty intense detail here. So as far as anyone else that fits the winners category from the receivers this past weekend, who comes to mind?
Quite a few, actually. There were more winners than there were losers, I think. I would include McConkey as a winner, even though mostly did exactly what was expected. And yeah, that's still good, though, because it clarifies a part of the profile. It means it's no longer an assumption. It's like, we know it's true. Ricky Pearsall had a pretty crazy combine. I know he's going to be 24 as a rookie, and that is conventionally an issue with evaluating prospects. But I think because way back at age 21 and a half, he was also an above baseline return as the leading receiver for Arizona State way back when they had Jaden Daniels. I think Pearsall deserves an exemption for the age, any age cutoffs you normally have, especially because when you test like he did, you know, that's a lot of explosiveness. That's, you know, clearly demonstrated the 4.41 40, like the 40 vertical, the 130 broad jump. Those are crazy. He had a really crazy three cone. I'm assuming for the RAS thing, he had to be like a top 10 all time tester at the combine, or top 20, something like that.
Yeah. So, he was number one among receivers in the three cone drill.
Oof. Yeah. That's pretty good. And you know, you watch him make a lot of big plays at Florida and Arizona State. It sort of makes sense now. It's just, he just can jump and, you know, run fast and stuff like that. So big winner Pearsall is. I think Jacob Cowing was a winner. I didn't know how he was going to test exactly. It's not always easy to tell from tape, but 4.38 40 really does it in my opinion. And I think his tape, his production is clearly great. Devontae Walker with North Carolina, that 4.36, that sort of that makes him kind of like a middle class man's Brian Thomas to me in this draft. Like same exact concerns, same strengths, and basically the possibility that he's a big play threat on the boundary and downfield in the NFL at plus efficiency. But yeah, I think that's the main like winner headliners for me.
Yeah, I pretty much had the same list. It's hard to really identify anyone else that like truly crushed it. I'm not going to say anything too much about like Johnny Wilson ran faster than I expected, but I thought he was going to run like a 4.7. So I'm still not a
his
big
best case scenario is tight end. I mean, they really just got to hope he can do a Darren Waller thing. And I don't know. Darren Waller was more convincing in my opinion at Georgia Tech.
Yeah, I think so too. And then circling back on Pearsall, you know, that with the age thing, you know, being concerned about him being at like the tip of his athletic development curve, when that's the top for you, that's good enough for me. Like, you know, again, the 42 inch vert, the insane short area stuff, we already know that he has great body control and really good hands. So I'm like firmly stamping. I think Pearsall, wherever he ends up, it I think would be justified to go in the second round, probably like second half of the second round. But even so, like I think he's definitely very solid. I'm a fan of his. Before we get into some of the guys who might have lost a little bit of ground at the receiver position, we got a quick message from our friends over at Blue Wire.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right. I'm bummed to say it, Mario. I'm a huge fan of his, but it wasn't a great weekend for my guy, Troy Franklin. You know, someone that I was, as far as the tape goes, or when I was watching Oregon this year, always came away super impressed. I kind of felt like he was some sort of like West Coast AJ Green type of guy. He is lanky like AJ Green, yes, but we don't really have a ton of precedent for a guy like Troy Franklin. Unfortunately, like he is tall and lanky, like he's 6'2 and change, but 176, that's a concern when you're that tall. Also kind of like surprisingly short arms and small hands for someone with that frame. Ran well, I thought, in the 40, you know, the low 4.4s is definitely solid for a guy with that height. And he had a decent vertical, not too far above average, 62nd percentile as far as that's concerned. But I don't know, man, what do we do with a guy who's 6'2", 176?
it's not the easiest call, in my opinion. There's sort of a lack of case studies like his, and that's what makes it tough. I think the outcome of Franklin's career is going to be another helpful data point in sort of mapping out the ranges of outcomes for the kind of traits and the production profile that he has. The concerning thing, if I'm going to try to go to just really quick illustration of the concern, 6'2", 176 is a sort of skinniness that is not just uncommon, like it's pretty rare. And if you're talking the sort of exemptions to the rule, you got to go straight to these unlikely cases, these probably anomalous cases like Devontae Smith, who is, 6 foot 170. We don't know what Devontae Smith would have run in the 40 because he didn't run it. It's possible that Devontae Smith would not have run a 4.41. It's possible he would have run something better or something worse. So not knowing any of these things makes it tougher to take Devontae Smith, who's otherwise, one of the closer comps for Franklin trait wise, and derive anything from it. It's just kind of, it's like, we still need to know more. We need to kind of know other variables before we can determine what we're looking at is what we think it is for the reasons that we would think it is. And in Devontae Smith's case, the reason he's exempt for being, otherwise quote too skinny, I think it's as simple as he has supernatural, coordination and hands and stuff like that. The kind of thing you just can't really expect anyone else to do. And so I'm not going to tell anyone who's concerned about Franklin's build, like, don't worry, he'll be exempt because it's like Devontae Smith. You just have to be like Devontae Smith. It's not easy to do that, even if Franklin is as fast or faster than Smith. And again, we don't really know that. So otherwise, your next comp is probably someone like Tyquan Thornton, who has almost the exact same frame, a little heavier actually than Franklin, like 5 pounds heavier or something like that, and also faster than the 40. Thornton ran the 4.27 or whatever it was at his combine at 181, 183, something like that. So Thornton, of course, has been a major disappointment in the NFL. Maybe it's too early to write him off entirely. Maybe injuries had something to do with it. Maybe it's just New England dysfunction that had everything to do with it. But it's also possible that Thornton will continue to struggle in the NFL. And it's possible that basically the reason that he struggled in the NFL at all was that for his game to work, he needed to be 20 pounds heavier or something, and he just wasn't. So it's probably not that simple, but it's like, these are just kind of, these are just the probabilities that we have to kind of shave down to try to figure out the whole puzzle. And with Franklin, you get it narrowed down to that Devontae Smith, Tyquan Thornton kind of range. And I don't know how you really zero in any more than that. And when you can't remove more uncertainties than that, that kind of puts you closer to, for me, round three than round one. Basically, with Mitchell, some of the same concerns as with Brian Thomas and Adonai Mitchell in terms of the target count nature and the application on the field. But actually, Franklin's production was way better at Oregon than either of those guys. And so for Franklin, if you just looked at his numbers at Oregon, you would not think target volume was a concern. His target numbers were great. His efficiency was great on that target workload. But the concern is, at 6'2", 176, will he be able to recreate those scenarios closely enough at the NFL level to have these traits, these skills that he seems to have as a receiver? Like, will they get the chance to show up at the NFL level, or will he lack the athletic traits necessary for his skill to show up in the first place? So I'm not trying to say like Franklin's got a red flag on him exactly. It's just he doesn't have obvious prior instances, and in a lot of ways the way that it goes for him will be the first way it goes for any receiver of his type. And so it's just kind of the first version of an experiment.
All right, I'm here for Pioneer Troy Franklin blazing the trail for tall skinny guys. I'm not a tall skinny guy, I'm just a short guy, but go Troy Franklin. But I am a little bit worried about I think he's going to have like a very specific role in order to have success at the next level. But I think the pressure will be off him in the sense that he's probably not going round one anymore. But if he can end up somewhere good on day two, keep an eye. You know, don't give up the ship just yet. But I'm a little bit bummed out about how last weekend went. He's really kind of the only guy that I was high on that I felt like fell flat among the receivers last weekend. Is there anyone else that kind of checked that box to you?
Yeah, nothing too bad. I thought even Franklin, I feel a little bad giving him like a loser label because he did okay. It's not, I've definitely seen, you know, a lot of receivers do worse. It's just not in this class. Like generally everybody did pretty well at the combine, or at least no one really fell short of expectations at the combine. So it's hard to identify anyone who actually lost ground. It seems like it's more so a lot of guys confirming what we thought, some gaining a little bit. But the biggest loser for me, I guess, would be someone like, I don't know, Isaiah Williams, and who cares?
Yeah, I don't know. Outside of Champaign, Illinois, I'm not sure how many people were like, oh, can't believe that.
It's over. Oh, God.
Well, you know, you can still root for Chase Brown this coming year, and excited about him. But
and their tight end, whatever is that Tip Raymond or whatever his name is.
Oh yes, Tip.
He's gonna block so fast, dude.
Oh my god,
so fast blocking.
You've never seen anything like it before. All right, well, that buttons it up as far as the receivers go. Let's get to the running backs, because, you know, it was really wide open going into last weekend. Like I felt like not only running back one was up for grabs, but really the entire top five was kind of up for negotiation. So we'll kind of start at the top. The guy who's kind of expected, you know, loosely holding the moniker of RB1 going into last weekend. What'd you make of Blake Corum's performance? Because I think at once it was nothing outstanding, but when you're concerned that it's going to be bad, like I was, I think it turns out to be pretty okay in his case. So 5'8", 205, a little bit less dense than I thought, although when you're 5'8", 205 is still fairly dense, but ran the okay 40-yard dash, low 4.5s. Had the good cone drill and the good shuttle time. So both of those things definitely worked in his favor. And being the kind of physical back that he is, I know that this thing doesn't really like translate directly or anything like that, but I like that he benched 27 times. Like back.
Yeah.
He's a man.
It gives him a little insight as to how he managed the workload volume he did at Michigan. It wasn't because he weighed 205 pounds. That's not how he did it. It's because he's got a little something extra as far as whatever football character, whatever you want to call it, and stuff like that can be real. It can be, you know, real currency for a prospect. It can help explain why some guys succeed and others who are similar don't. And where, you know, while with Corum, you know, he's going to have like low size adjusted speed scores, stuff like that. At least you don't have to worry about him failing because of, you know, ending up in the doghouse, or at least, you know, he's the kind of player you have to worry about that least with, I would say. And if for fantasy purposes and for, I guess, the real draft purposes, it remains difficult for me to sort through this running back class, even with some of the winners. Even with some of the losers from the combine clarifying the picture somewhat, it remains wide open to me. And part of the reason why is the ones who have been regarded as the winners at the combine at running back still don't project for the volume upside that Corum can in the NFL. And specifically, I don't even mean so much the 205. Obviously, that's not a selling point. I do think Corum is probably volume viable in the NFL, but I'm just basing it on just the fact that he's done it a lot of times already. I think there really is something to pacing and knowing how to lean into the hits the right way. And I think Corum has earned the benefit of the doubt as far as stuff like that goes. If you want him to, and including, you know, halfback dives and stuff like that, you know, a lot of the times the volume limitation isn't just that the running back can't literally take that many hits. It's that they can't get to whatever carry count you have in mind unless they can run out of this category of carry. And if they can't handle that play, if they rotate him out for some other guy, it doesn't matter if he could take 20 more hits a game. He's not going to be on the field in the situations necessary to get the ball that many times, you know? So whereas a Tony Pollard type, I think, will always be at risk of getting rotated out on a halfback dive. You can leave Corum on the field for that purpose. If he has to rotate out, it's never going to be because he can't function in the situation. It would just come down to, you know, he's a little gassed because he's 205 pounds and this is the NFL now. Like that's what could happen. But also what could happen is Corum could pretty easily rebrand as a running back. You know, he has the volume ability, yes, but like Jaylen Warren, I guess you might point out, if you take a guy who's a workhorse at the NFL level and then you make him play out of the bullpen in the NFL, he'll look a little faster. He's not the 20 carry Oklahoma State Jaylen Warren. Now he's 10 carry, 4 catch Jaylen Warren, you know? And Blake Corum is good enough as a pass catcher that he could take over as a team's passing down guy. He can take over right away a 400 snap role as a third down back, or he could take over, you know, a rotational role with other running backs, whatever, up to probably like 600 snaps or so. And I think the question is, you know, will he get the opportunity to do it? That's where it gets difficult, because if Corum fell to, I'd be surprised, I guess, if he fell to the fifth round, but if he were like the fifth running back taken, that would not be surprising. And if at least four teams are taking running backs ahead of him, then, you know, that's four fewer teams that might have given him that chance. And I can't tell which way it's going to head, but I do think that teams will like him. I doubt there will be many teams that look at him for whatever reason and say, oh, gross, no. I think he'll probably win over pretty much anybody who's around him, and whatever team he gets onto, he will start quickly and steadily, I think, getting his foot in the door on offense, because there's just whatever there is to do, he can do it. You know, run between the tackles, run outside, pass catching, he can do all those things. It's just, will he get the chance? And if he gets the chance, like how much physically can he hold up with it?
Yeah, I think he can be a solid pro. And I think to your point, it's varied what he can be, but I think he'd be effective either way. Like whether it is being the number one in a backfield or more of that rotational piece. I think the Warren comp could be interesting if he ends up in that type of situation. But yeah, I mean, you look at the pass catching efficiency that he had over his time at Michigan. It's solid. It's not the craziest volume you've ever seen, but on an efficiency basis, good. I think he's got good hands. The physicality that he has, I think, you know, he's definitely going to not have that rookie concern of, oh, can he pick up the blitz? Like I think he's pretty hungry to light somebody up when he gets the chance. And yeah, he carried the Michigan offense the last couple of seasons, especially these last two, and you know that they made it to the playoff. They won the national championship this past year. Like I do like Blake Corum. I think I like him a little bit more as a pro prospect coming out of last weekend than I did entering it. So I give him the thumbs up there. Though I will say, and you know, this could be a bit dicey of a gamble here, Mario, but I'm so enamored with Jalen Wright. I think I got to have him as my rookie running back one right now.
That's fair enough. I see certain strengths and certain weaknesses or questions anyway with Wright. The main limitation with him depends on which way you want to say it, I guess. But I worry that Wright might not fit on all types of running back setups as a ball carrier, especially. Specifically, I don't know if he's really a between the tackles guy. I don't know if you want him running between the tackles more than occasionally. And I think you, beyond that, want to emphasize sweeps, draws, stuff like that as a runner, because while he has that clearly blistering speed and he has a certain amount of skill with the football, I don't see the kind of strides that fit well between the tackles, especially like toward the guards. The more it's a halfback dive, the more I worry about a guy like him, because while Wright can turn the corner and split the safeties from anywhere, I worry that if it comes down to a situation where, for instance, Blake Corum would do well having to kind of spin away in a phone booth from a linebacker or something like that, without getting his head ripped off by just, you know, running into the defensive tackle right next to him, I don't know if Wright is the running back to handle that task. And so I think it might be best fit for him to be more like a 12 carry kind of running back than a, you know, 16 to 21. But if he's a rotational back, that's would at most be just kind of like a fantasy concern. It wouldn't necessarily be a reason for the team drafting him to not see that level of value up to like the second round, I guess, because if you are a team that is built such that your concerns, your list of concerns are, you know, taken care of more or less, and you're just kind of luxury shopping at this point, and you see a way in the second round to basically push a button and improve 450 of your running back snaps and give you, you know, long range striking ability for 450 snaps that you didn't last year and otherwise would not without this pick, it makes sense to make that pick. Even if you know, some of those so-called analytics guys get mad about it or saying like, oh, this is an inefficient use of a role playing running back. Like, sometimes you are just a 3-point shooter away. And sometimes that one bit of just extra juice is, it's not going to be the reason singularly why you maybe go all the way, but it could very much be part of it. And you know, sometimes you just got to upgrade your 20 snaps, 30 snaps a game, even if that's all you can do at one spot. Sometimes you just got to do it. And if you are looking for big playability, he pretty much showed it at Tennessee and, you know, running a 4.38 at 210. It removes any doubt pretty much. It's not as far as that one application, doesn't mean he's going to be great in the NFL, but it means at least for the big playability that will be there. And if he disappoints, it won't be because it wasn't.
Yeah. But with Wright, you know, I think you can also point to like what he never had more than 146 carries in a college season. So it's like, you know, where's the volume? But I think you can kind of flip that question like back on itself where it's like, well, for one, you got to remember what Tennessee's offense was. You know, it was so explosive through the air. These last couple of years, like under Hendon Hooker, of course, and then you know, to a lesser extent under Joe Milton, but it's the Heupel offense is not one that often features like a 250 carry type of running back. And Tennessee also had a deep backfield. Like we're seeing it more and more in the SEC now, where like there's less Ray Davises, right? Like that or Cody Schrader's. Like there's more of like a varied backfield approach, you know, using and drawing upon the depth that you have in the backfield. I want to say Dylan Sampson was the other running back for Tennessee this past year.
Jabari Small.
Yeah. So, I mean, like those guys are not nobodies. I think Sampson is someone that we'll be talking about next year. So I'm not worried about the volume. If anything, you know, I think it might be a slight mark in Wright's favor that we could have untapped volume potential because he doesn't have like the insane tread worn off of his tires just yet. Again, the 4.38 and the 40 led the position in the broad jump and had a strong vert as well. I think you bring up some good concerns as to like, can he do everything that you'd ask of a running back? But if you just play to his strengths, I think his strengths are loud enough to where he's an impact guy.
Yeah, I agree. The only other thing he'll need to keep an eye on is the fumbling, because he had 4 fumbles on only 148 touches in 2022, but he only had 1 fumble on 159 touches in 2023.
Okay, so a bit of an improvement in the ball security realm there.
Also, John, I got to ask you, I guess, he didn't get many chances, so this doesn't mean he can't do it, but do you have any sense of whether Wright is a plus or potentially plus pass catcher?
I don't.
That's the one thing about him. If he's kind of like a running specialist, big playback. I like players like that, but sometimes they kind of Rashad Penny is this kind of running back, for instance. Like if they don't stand out as pass catchers, it's a lot of coaches' inclination to like lump in the fast guys together and then remove the one because, oh, he's not the passing down one. But yeah. I don't know either way on that one. And if at the very least, if Wright's passing down application is not a concern, it is easy to imagine most offenses having like 500 snaps available for a player like him.
Might be an embarrassing question for me to be asking right now, but like, was it so obvious that Alvin Kamara was going to be an amazing pass catcher when he was coming out of Tennessee?
I thought so, but that was a weird offense because they were doing like borderline wishbone stuff with Josh Dobbs at the time. But I thought Kamara was, yes, awesome as a pass catcher at Tennessee. The one thing is, you know, it is a good example, Kamara, at least, of when it's tough to determine the volume capacity of a player. In hindsight, you could say about Kamara, he just didn't get him more carries because Jalen Hurd was there, which is, you know, obvious enough of a reason. And yeah, I guess as far as the volume upside with Wright goes, we'll see how much of it was just those other two guys getting in the way of whatever situation it is, as a runner or a pass catcher. It seems like they kind of got in the way, and we'll see, you know, ultimately what the reason was for that.
We sure will. Either way, count me right now as being excited about one Jalen Wright. We'll see, you know, where he ends up, what range in the draft, everything like that. But I think he's in the discussion to be the first running back off the board at this stage.
He might be the favorite. I mean, I don't see any reason. I know we haven't gotten to Benson yet, but I don't see any reason to put Benson ahead of Wright.
I don't either, and I like Benson a lot, yeah, as we'll get into here. But do you have a question from our listener, Jerry? He has a dynasty question for us. If you were him, would you trade away the sixth pick in the rookie draft, 106, Deshaun Watson and Cooper Kupp, to get the second pick in the rookie draft this year and the first pick of the third round in the rookie draft?
That sounds like a lot to give up, but I guess if you're looking at a trade like that, you might be looking for a rebuild opportunity anyway. And I guess, you know, there is a big drop off, I think, from the top three picks and even the fourth pick to the fifth pick this year. Like I guess for me, it's like Ladd McConkey and Caleb Williams that you start talking about after Brock Bowers. And those first three receivers, you know, that there's a big gap between them and then whatever the fourth receiver might be to go off the board. So if you're specifically, for whatever reason, looking to get like a blue chip, you know, five-star prospect, then a trade like that will give you the chance to get. I would take Odunze if Harrison goes first. Some might argue for Neighbors, and I won't push back. But I think Odunze has the higher floor, especially for like PPR scoring. I just, if you think you might compete this year, I don't know if you want to make a trade like that, just because if Watson somehow comes back and if Kupp somehow is just 85% of what he was, you know, 2 years ago, then you might wish you had gotten more in that trade. So, yeah, I guess maybe try to get more back too. Try to give less or get more while you're at it.
Yeah, make that third rounder a second round pick, that type of thing. Yeah,
barely something like that. Maybe actually try to get like another first rounder or something, and if they have it, and otherwise, yeah, the second.
Yeah, because in a dynasty, you know, right now, like, you know, Kupp is still excellent, and Watson, the jury's kind of out, obviously, or maybe that's not the right way to put it, but you know, if he does tap back into the late Houston days, then you know that you'll have given away a really like blue chip talent at the quarterback position, and especially if this dynasty is a super flex, and you know that's obviously
gonna sting. If it's super flex, you got to make them bleed for Watson.
Make them bleed. All right, let's talk about the aforementioned Trey Benson out of Florida State by way of Oregon. You had a really good breakdown of him last week, I thought, but you know, coming out of the combine, checking in at 6'2", 216, runs the 4.39 in the 40. Not great on the jumps, but yeah, oh well. Can't have it all, I suppose. But what do we make of him at this stage now that we know his athletic testing?
So yeah, 6'2", 216 was maybe a little bit lighter than was expected of Benson, but it's fine. And it's especially fine, in my opinion. This might sound backhanded, but it's not meant to be. I just think Benson is going to have some amount of volume limitation, like a soft cap anyway, on his carry volume, I guess, especially between the guards, between the tackles. And I feel even more strongly about this than I do in the case of Wright. You know, I was trying to kind of be critical of the game tape and try to see things in a critical way. And I mentioned with Wright that I don't see so obviously the ability to break down between the guards and in that part of the field. With Benson, I feel like it's more clear, and it makes sense that it would be more clear. He's an inch taller. He's more clearly upright, and Benson does good at kind of getting into a squat. It's just that it takes him some gathering and like a regeneration of his movement that's at a higher cost than it is for someone who's more naturally lower built than him. And some running backs just more easily, effortlessly even have kind of like a lean that is helpful for running away from people, even when they are trying to, you know, catch you from all directions at the same time. And I don't know if Benson's that. I think Benson's more in his bag when it's like you get him a toss to the corner, or you get some amount of space for him, because you can see right away he can really run. It's just the space is somewhat necessary for it to show up, and I don't know how much he'll be able to create the space again, especially between the tackles. Once you get him a little room, he'll juke people and stuff. It's not as if he lacks wiggle. It's more like how quickly does it take him to reload when he needs to like break down, stop, change direction. And I don't know if it suits him that well, but between the guards. So Benson's best role, I think it might be the same best role as with Wright, which is to say a guy you give more like 12 to 15 carries to. And I think Benson has shown a little more as a pass catcher than Wright. I guess I got to give him that. I'd be surprised if Benson struggled as a pass catcher. With Wright, it's not that I expect it. It's just it's a little harder to tell either way, I think, whereas I think Benson has kind of earned a benefit of the doubt to some extent there. So you can imagine, even if Benson can't get his carry volume up to a certain point because he can't run between the guards, like even if that's a given, he can still, like Wright, be uniquely explosive on 12 to 14 carries and then whatever, 2, 3, 4, 5 catches, something like that. So both players, both Jalen Wright and Trey Benson, I think, yeah, I should have thought of this before. The model for them might be Raheem Mostert in Miami and San Francisco, right? Because he was ideally you'd get a little more pass catching, but at worst, you saw what a 12 to 15 carry running back can do with that level of explosiveness. Like even if you're mostly using him off tackle, even if you're not giving him halfback dives with a fullback lead blocker, you can get enough big plays out of them and you know, give the defense enough of a scare with those off tackle plays that it still fits together. So both Wright and Trey Benson will need, I think, to be, you know, 4.5 yards per carry plus kind of players. But it's just kind of easy to imagine that, especially if they are in rotational roles, especially if they're in roles that don't make them do the things that they're worst at. If they're in a role that more so asks them to do what their strengths are, I think either of those guys could give you like 6 yards a carry up to something like 150 carries.
Well, that's certainly interesting. And, you know, like you chop the volume down a little bit, but you ramp up the efficiency and the end result ends up looking pretty good. And, you know, when the efficiency is legitimately explosive, probably think about some touchdowns in there as well, like we saw.
But you see how tough it is to rank these guys, because it's like with Benson and Wright, you see all this obvious big playability. And then with Corum, just as obviously you don't have that big playability yet. It's like Corum still might be able to catch those guys if he's, you know, just getting more snaps or getting more carries and catches or something like that. So it's tough to, in my opinion, to tell which of these running backs is the best fantasy asset. It might be a little easier after the NFL draft to call it, but yeah, right now it's kind of just, there's a wide open, I think, race for these guys, and it's kind of hard to rule out. Even if we're going to get to Isaac Guerrero, even a guy like him, it's tough to rule out. Another, you know, Mostert comp.
Yes, no, that is a good Mostert comp. But right now, do you see the three guys we just talked about in Corum, Wright, and Benson as like the pretty firm first tier of running backs, the top three?
I think. What was the other one? Yeah, I think Guerrero actually has a case to be in that same group, and it's tough to rank them definitively. If anyone wants to rank any of those guys ahead of the others, I don't really have an argument with it. But my guess right now is I would say Jalen Wright is the first one drafted, and I don't know. I because of Benson's knee injury history and Guerrero being kind of like unproven, I could see it being Corum who's up next, but I could also see any of those fast guys going ahead of Corum. The wild card for me, John, don't know how much time we got about for him. We don't need much really, is Kamani Vidal from Troy at 5'8", 213. Very dense build, workhorse viable, both in the ability to handle the volume and the ability to handle all conceivable tasks. Like any run play, any pass play, Vidal can be on the field. 4.46 40 at that. That's, I mean, the NFL might still sort of just not care and for whatever reason ignore him, but I don't know why they would. This sure seems like an NFL starter to me.
Yeah, I like Vidal. If you're unfamiliar with his game, it's because he went to Troy. But he's basically just, yeah, like imagine trying to tackle like a fast fire hydrant or something. Like, you know, that seems difficult. Six.
I think most the over under on his 40 probably would have been like a 4.64 or something. And he ran a 4.46. So not many. I can't remember the last time someone was that short and over 210 and running like that.
Yeah, that's good stuff right there. Definitely like that. Let's unpack Garendo a little bit more, because I think no one in terms of like orders of magnitude, like did more for themselves among the fantasy guys last weekend than him, where, you know, he went from someone that you wouldn't even blame the casual fan for not even really knowing who he was. Then he runs the fastest 40 of any of the running backs at the combine, one of the fastest ever for someone with that weight. I think, like, if you put the filter at like 220, I think only Keith Marshall has run a faster one in recent years, and poor Keith just couldn't stay healthy. But I don't know, what do you make of Garendo? Because, you know, the it makes you go back to the production a little bit. I think you can't really blame him for not having the huge role at Wisconsin, because they had Braylon Allen. I think Jonathan Taylor might have been there for the tail end. I might be mistiming that one up a little bit. But then, you know, this past year at Louisville, splitting time with Juwan Jordan, first year in the offense, you know, you can't blame him for not necessarily having a huge role in that offense either. But the efficiency throughout his last 3 years in college was always strong. It just, he wasn't getting a ton of work. But now you see the athletic testing and you're like, what the heck, coaches? What the heck, Paul Christ? What were you doing?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of projection, or maybe a lot, required with Garendo just because he hasn't played very much. And you said, and I, or as you were hinting, and I certainly think this, there's basically some excuse for that. There's situationally, there's excuses for why Garendo didn't put up numbers. It's not the case that you look at his lack of numbers and then say, oh, it's because he failed to do anything. It's just, you can't really go that far. So sometimes cases like his happen. Sometimes players are just kind of denied opportunity, even though they are more than capable and would put up better numbers other places. Sometimes they can even put up better numbers in the places they're not getting the opportunity. I mean, it is the possibility that Wisconsin, good as Braylon Allen was, maybe Garendo would have given them more. Maybe it would have taken a couple games for them to see it, but maybe the third game, you know, they're doing like a rotation and all of a sudden Garendo gets a couple 40-yard touchdowns and everything's different after that. That kind of stuff can happen. So, and not that it's a similar kind of player, but in terms of guys managing to transfer and sort of go their whole career never playing at running back, you can remember Chris Carson, Georgia, and Oklahoma State. There was a case like that. So there really isn't a whole lot, in my opinion, that says conclusively that Garendo cannot play in the NFL. Not just that, I don't think there's a lot of evidence that he can't be a pretty high level player in the NFL. So the question for me is, like, you know, if that excuse of not playing over Allen is valid, and if not playing over Juwan Jordan at Louisville is valid, two things that I think are valid excuses, then, like, how much does it scale up exactly? What can we actually rule out with Garendo? And there's not a whole lot for me. I think just watching him run, that, like these guys that we've just talked about, and like a lot of higher built running backs, are, you don't want them running between the guards that much. You like them more in space, going toward the corner, things like that. And in those kinds of roles, again, like the Raheem Mostert in San Francisco and Miami role, like that kind of stuff, Garendo should be kind of awesome. I mean, there's nothing in that list of tasks that he doesn't project very well at. And one thing to keep in mind for his fantasy upside, hopefully I'm not reading into it too much, but I thought, like, watching Garendo play, you could see he is a plus pass catcher. And I think there's a pretty good chance he could be like a 50-60 catch running back at the NFL level. So even if his carry volume is contained because he doesn't really get the halfback dive, short yardage kind of stuff, not that we need to assume that that's the case, but even if we do assume that that's a given, he could, as a fantasy asset, bridge the difference by catching passes. And I think on a, you know, pretty explosive basis, like you get him a well set up screen pass, it's kind of easy to imagine how it could turn into an 80 yard touchdown if everyone does their job. So Guarendo looks like it's easy to me. It looks like it's easy for him to catch the ball and run with it. So as much as there's nothing in you know, draft media indicating that he has stock to this effect, I think there is ultimately a case for him to be the top fantasy back in the draft. It's just like all these guys, there's so much that'll sway his outcome based on like the opportunity that he's given. And until we know that, it's kind of hard to know much else. But I think Guarendo, you know, with 220, he can handle the workload conventionally in terms of just the beating of it. It's just the question of like what opportunity will he get to that carry count. That's more the question to me. And I don't know, I'm pretty optimistic. I think he could. I'm trying to think of a comp, but nothing immediately comes to mind. It always goes back to the Mostert one because of just the off tackle, you know, 6 yards a carry kind of deal. Like that's something Guarendo should be able to do.
I'm into that. And you know, we'll see when it comes to the fantasy side of this. You know, this is a huge free agent running back class. You know, Saquon Barkley's potentially, Derrick Henry, Josh Jacobs, you know, a handful of other guys. So we'll see where those chips fall. And then obviously we have the luxury of the draft coming after that. But at the very least, like Guarendo needs to be on your short list. Like when you're watching the draft this April, like, pay very close attention to where he ends up because he could be very interesting. And, you know, it took an hour to get here, so I think enough time has passed. I'm going to go ahead and pat myself on the back for saying that he was going to do pretty well last week. And I didn't say that he was going to do that well, but I did say that he was a good dart throw for fastest 40 among the running backs. But yeah,
well, I think that's exactly what happened, wasn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay. So it was exactly to be a little pedantic. That was exactly what you said. Not a little different.
So I was pretty jazzed about that. I think I was like getting back from a run on Saturday right after the running backs had tested, and I saw Twitter was exploding about Guarendo, and I was like, let's go. Rounding it out. So slightly dovetailing off of this topic, I do have some. Rookie best ball takeaways. I did one on Monday after the combine, and just kind of looking at where the rookies are falling as a result of the combine. We're still kind of seeing a decent bit of market movement, but Marvin Harrison, no matter where he goes team wise, getting him with the third pick in the second round is not something I'm going to be doing, period. Beyond that, A.D. Mitchell going in like the ninth round. How does that strike you?
I would say it seems a little risky, but I don't think it is, because it's more, I don't know if it's risky as much as it's volatile in the sense that, you know, there's upside there and a wide range of outcomes possible, but I don't think the lower end of that range of outcomes is truly that low. Like I'd be totally shocked if like the Denzel Mims scenario occurred. Like I feel pretty comfortable saying like that's just not a good comp. It's not adequate. So yeah, if the Bills are the team that drafts Mitchell, he'll go much higher than the ninth round. I don't know if that's I don't actually know if that's the right way to for people to respond, because I happen to think that Gabe Davis role is locked into a low target rate by design, more or less. But he would be. His stock would go crazy if he were drafted by a team like that. And so part of drafting right now for the rookies is just kind of imagining scenarios like that. Not so much asking yourself what you even think about the player specifically, but more like how will the markets react if X, Y, or Z happens, and maybe I should cover my bases in case any of them do happen, sort of thing.
Right. Like, you know, project out the range and who would be drafting at that position in that range, I think is a good like kind of basic framework to be working off of when it comes to taking these rookies in best ball right now. And then we broke down the running back. So I don't have a ton to add there. I did mention
that's a tough spot, man. I would just take the cheapest ones, because trying to guess, trying to act like anyone knows what's going to happen to the extent of putting like four or five rounds between these guys, it's just not worth it. I'd just rather take the cheaper one rather than pay to take the mystery bag.
Well, that's what I was able to do, and I got the guy that I wanted. Like, I got Jalen Wright in the 13th round, and that was after Braylon Allen, Marshawn Lloyd.
Whoa. Okay, yeah. Apparently I got to get into some of these. I was just telling John, like, I haven't been doing these because I'm all anxious about like the free agent things moving or this or that. It's like, I didn't know people were taking like Marshawn Lloyd in the 10th round. I forgot that that's part of how that early winter best ball goes. So, like, people using like Phil Steele rankings or whatever to do their rookie ADP.
Get amongst it, man. Yeah, it's kind of wild out there. Rounding it out, I'm going to throw some names at you here as guys that I'm probably going to be taking a decent amount of once you get to the later stages of the draft. I do like Demario Douglas, where he's going in like the 13th, 14th round. I like Chris Rodriguez, where he's going in the 16th, 17th. I'm going to have a lot of Davis Allen of the Rams at cheap tight end three. Interested. This guy was unable to test this past weekend, but I did like Rasheen Ali a decent amount at Marshall. So I think he's a decent dart throw late on. And I thought Brevin Jordan was, but then Dalton Schultz re-signed. So that's probably moot, but we'll see. I mean, he came on pretty strong at the end of last year, too.
Yeah. The one thing about Ali is does he have like that biceps tear or whatever?
Correct.
Like, so that might make it a little tough, but I don't know. I'd be looking at, especially for Vidal, I guess, in that if he's still going in the 20th round, I imagine he was, or 18th yep. round, whatever. Maybe that day has passed us, but if not, I would get more shares now, because if conventional draft media starts hyping him at all, I mean, all the objective indicators say that he can play the NFL and as a runner and pass catcher both. So yeah, otherwise the Davis Allen one is one of those where if Tyler Higbee stays out, then Allen would be a pretty good candidate to play basically as many snaps as the Rams have laying around for him. And Higbee would sometimes get up to, like, you know, 65 snaps a game, wore him out clearly, but Allen's just getting started. So as long as he can make it a year or two under the brutal, they make them block a lot, run in, pass catching both. But if you play 60 snaps a game with Matt Stafford, and if Matt Stafford's throwing 40 touchdowns, then whoever the tight end is, whoever's playing those snaps, has a sort of, you know, they're anchored to the fortunes of the Rams offense at a pretty low price.
And for what it's worth, it obviously tiny sample as far as his what he was able to do this past year, but he passed the eye test against the Ravens in that game that the Rams, you know, took the Ravens all the way to overtime. And there's another game late in the season where I thought he had a strong performance. So, again, there's a lot of unknown there. It's not like he was a super heralded draft pick or anything like that. But, you know, he was a productive guy at a big school like Clemson. And I think the role's open for him. So, if you're looking for a late tight end, yeah, that guys like Trey McBride really worked out for people last year. I don't know if the exact same thing can happen, especially when you have Kupp and Nacua there, but I don't know. I'm interested at the very least.
Again, I think it's, you know, he's mostly going to block until they get to the 20 yard line, but Stafford throws touchdowns. And if you're out there, you can get one.
Yeah, just, I mean, get an 18th, 19th round pick that gets you 6-7 touchdowns. Like, you'll definitely take that. But that's going to round it out for us here on the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast. Again, breaking down the combine winners and losers. If you want to get in behind the RotoWire paywall, a little free trial action, go to rotowire.com/pod. For Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. Thanks for listening.
Spring is in the air at Littleton Coin Company, and we want to help you brighten your collection. Visit us at littletoncoin.com all month long to enjoy 15% off your purchase. With a wide selection of coins, paper money, supplies, and more, Littleton Coin Company has something for every collector's taste. Use promo code SPRING at littletoncoin.com for 15% off your purchase all month long. Restrictions apply. Littleton Coin Company. Serving collectors since 1945.